This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I have in the studio with me Ray Krohn, who spent more than 10 years behind bars, including a couple years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. Today, Ray Krohn serves as Director of Communications and Training for the organization Witness to Innocence. Ray Krohn, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I'm very interested in hearing your story. Why don't you start me from the beginning, or even before the beginning, where you grew up and how you fell into this incredible circumstance?
Well, I was from a small agricultural town in south central Pennsylvania, in a small town. Ethics and morals and values that you have where you grew up in the same place where your grandparents went to high school, your great-grandparents went to church. I was in the Boy Scouts, the church choir. Did good in sports and in school. When I graduated, I went in the Air Force and was stationed in different places, Texas, Mississippi, Georgia, Maine. And then I got sent to Phoenix, Arizona. My 6 years were up. I liked it out there. It was sunny and warm. Lots of things to do. People from all over, easy to meet people. Got a job with the post office, bought my own house, and life was good. And then there was a murder at a local bar that I played darts for. I played volleyball at the bar. There was nothing stolen. There was no robbery. The police believed it had to be somebody that knew her. They interviewed me believing I was a boyfriend. I said I wasn't. They thought I was lying. They noticed I had crooked teeth. They found marks in the body and arrested me saying that my teeth matched those marks in the body.
What was your reaction the instant you got arrested there?
Well, at first, when they first questioned me, I had nothing to worry about. I didn't do anything. But then when I was thrown on the ground, handcuffed and arrested, just stepping out of my car, getting home from work that day, I was outraged. I was, why don't you believe me? What is this about? But it's funny, those first couple hours and days in the Maricopa County jail out there, all I thought about was, did I lock my car? Who's feeding my dog? I need to get up out of here. They need me to pitch on the softball team this weekend. I believed that they were out there continuing their investigation and going to find that everything I told them was true and that I'd be out of there. 7 months later, I was in trial with a court-appointed attorney that the states had granted $5,000 to defend me. You can't even get a divorce for $5,000. So it was a quick, short trial. The key evidence was all bite mark evidence. A well-spoken man, a lot of credentials, testified that the marks on the body matched my teeth. My teeth were unique as a result of a car accident when I was young.
So this was some expert witness they brought in?
An expert witness they brought in from Nevada. And like I say, very well-spoken, very powerful speaker, also very well-paid. It turned out he got over $50,000 for his testimony in my case, 10 times what we got for defense.
And what was your defense lawyer like?
Well, my defense lawyer was appointed by the courts to represent me. He was a private attorney. As I say, he got $5,000 to pay for represent me. He wanted me to take a plea bargain. Of course, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything. And how could I get in trouble for something like this, especially a horrible murder?
What do you want you to plead to?
He wanted me to plead to second-degree murder. I've been facing probably 21 to 25 years. Instead, we went to trial, and pretty much the whole defense was me testifying and my roommate who lived in my house at the time, who knows I never left the house at night, testifying. And the prosecutor cross-examining by saying that you'd lie to protect your friend. And a man that had raised his right hand to serve in the U.S. Air Force took an oath of honor, a man who raised his right hand in that court of law to tell the truth. And in less than a minute's time, the prosecutor said, he's a liar, you can't believe him. It took the jury just 3.5 hours to find me guilty. Then since I didn't show remorse, how do you show remorse for something you didn't do? I was called a cold-blooded killer, unremorseful monster, and was sentenced to death.
Hmm. Were you surprised that sentence came down?
Actually, by that point, I'd been through the system for 7 months. I was in the county jail with other people going to trial. I started seeing, things that were happening around me, stuff that a person that believed in the justice system, a person that never had any trouble with the law, would not have believed it could be like this. So I wasn't really surprised. And actually, to tell you the truth, they might as well have killed me. They took my life from me, my career with the post office, my home, all my property. To me, it was like I was in another world anyhow. This wasn't the Ray Krohn's life. This was somebody else's story now.
So was it surreal at the moment, or did something go through your mind when that decision, that when you heard the words, sentenced to death, that, just sort of, swore to yourself or said, holy smokes, this is it?
It really started getting surreal after the point, and I realized in the county jail that they were going to try to take me to trial for this murder that I didn't do. And so then the progressiveness of it kept getting more stranger and stranger and odder and odder. But you somehow still survived and lived through that. But you couldn't believe anything was happening more, and it was out of your control.
It's a total out-of-body experience, it sounds like. I'm speaking with Ray Crone. He serves as Director of Communications and Training for the organization Witness to Innocence. This is about death row inmates who have been exonerated. And he was behind bars for a total of 10 years, including a couple on death row before he was exonerated. So you got an appeal. And the appeal gave you a new trial, and yet that new trial, you got convicted again. Walk me through that.
That was the most horrible part of the whole ordeal in a lot of ways. The prosecutor withheld evidence. When the Arizona Supreme Court reviewed it, they said that the judge was wrong for allowing this evidence in. They ordered a new trial because they said this was key evidence. It was a video made by the expert about the bite mark, how he identified me and matched it. We got this evidence the day before trial started. We asked for a continuance. The judge denied it. The Supreme Court of Arizona said that this was, you know, clearly this was a bite mark case. This was the main evidence, and they ordered a new trial. And by now, me and my family both realized that this was serious. This was not going to go away. They had executed 6 people while I was on Arizona's death row. I knew they didn't care if you were guilty or innocent. And my family realized this was serious. They cashed in their retirement funds. They mortgaged their house, and we got an attorney out of Southern California. Again, we couldn't come up with the hundreds of thousands of dollars it cost, but this man was familiar with my case and believed in me, and so he took it for minimal fee. And that trial lasted 6.5 weeks. And during that trial, DNA evidence even came out. The bite mark that I'm supposed to have made, there was a saliva sample taken from that area. That DNA on that saliva was not my saliva. And at the end, the prosecutor actually told the jury to disregard that, to ignore that, it's easy to explain. She's a waitress. She handles glasses and bottles all day long. That was just transferred there by accident off of somebody else's glass. This bite mark was on her breast.
And the jury bought that.
The jury believed. They said DNA. Actually, they talked to my attorney afterwards. They were crying during the when they released the verdict, and they said it just got too confusing, the DNA. And so they analyzed the bite mark themselves and matched each teeth individually and said that it was a match. And they became their own experts.
Were they out for a while, the jury, this time?
They were out for 3.5 days this time. Yes.
That must have been a shattering verdict when it came down. What did you feel like at that moment?
Well, it was so hard because I still believed in the system. I still believed in what our American way of truth and justice, of reasonable doubt. And reasonable doubt came out all during this trial. My attorney had done his homework. But what really the most shattering, the most painful was when that jury announced the guilty verdict, to hear this horrible scream, this moan, this wail from my mom and sister who had sat through those 6.5 weeks, not 5 feet behind me, just let out this horrible wail. And I looked at them. I said, it'll be okay. I looked at the jury who, as I said, was wiping tears out of their eyes. The bailiff, who was still reading the verdict's voice, was breaking up. My attorney's hanging on my shoulder saying, I can't believe this. I'm still with you, Ray. Don't worry. I'm with you till the end. And I look over at the prosecutor's table, and they're jumping up and down, high-fiving it like they just won the big game. And all I could think was, stop, rewind, start this over. This can't be possible, because I still believed.
Hmm. And did you ever stop believing?
No, and it's easy sometimes when all the weight of a system and a state comes down on you and calls you this monster, convicts you of murder, wants to take your life, you know, call you human garbage. But my family and friends believed in me all that time. They, you know, when you have somebody supporting you, it's hard to let go. You want to hold on for them too, because they were holding on for me. So that gave me the strength through all those years to keep fighting and to keep believing that something good can happen, because I knew I was innocent and my family believed in my innocence.
And did any friends, you know, stop believing you after the second conviction? Because I remember, you know, the Hurricane Carter case, the boxer that Bob Dylan sang about. You know, he was convicted twice too. And, you know, some people say, well, God, I can see, you know, once the jury screwing up or the system screwing up, but twice, that's not likely the guy's probably guilty. Mm-hmm. Do you have that kind of reaction from people?
I think the public normally does have that reaction, because we just, again, we want to believe in the system. And again, fortunately, my friends and people knew. I was 35 when this happened to me, so I'd established myself as a man, as an adult. People knew who I was. And as a response to the Hurricane Carter, I actually had a second cousin who, this was when he was in college, this was a big story for him and something they really followed in the songs, of course. And he actually got involved in my case, and he lived in California. So he was very prominent in doing a lot of the legwork and going out and working and meeting with other experts and trying to help me fight this whole ordeal of 10 years.
Well, how'd you finally get get an appeal that worked?
Fortunately for me, in Arizona, in around year 2000, the state legislatures passed a new law allowing inmates to have DNA testing done on previously untested material. In my case, she was found stabbed to death in the men's bathroom. Her clothes had been cut off of her with a butcher knife from the kitchen. Those clothes, her pants and underwear, were thrown in a corner. They had never been tested. Fortunately, the police had saved that clothing. We could see from just a routine observation of it that there were spots on this clothing. We petitioned the judge to have testing done. The prosecutor's office, the attorney general's office, objected, said it was a wild goose chase, a fishing expedition, a waste of the court's time and money. They told the judge not to grant this motion. Fortunately, that judge ordered that testing done, and he ordered it done by the Phoenix Police Department's crime lab. As a result of that, they extracted DNA from the pants and underwear. The DNA from both the sources were the same. They compared it to me, and it wasn't me, and compared it to Kim and Kona, the victim, and it wasn't Kim. And then on their own, and God bless this lab technician, she took that DNA sample and plugged it in the nationwide DNA data bank. This is where DNA was being stored from people all around the country. In Arizona at that time, there was about 16,000 DNA samples stored. It was from people who were convicted of either a sexual offense or a murder, were required to give blood samples. And when that blood was put in the DNA data bank, that DNA sample, it came back with a match. And it came back with a match to a man that at that time was serving a 10-year sentence for having sexually assaulted a child just 3 weeks after the murder. A man who was on parole at the time of the murder for another sexual offense years earlier. The parole address was his mom's house, not even four blocks from the bar in Phoenix, Arizona.
And so once they found the match, was it pretty much open and shut then?
There was still a little resistance from the prosecutor's office. My attorney, investigator, went down to visit this man in the yard there. He was only 3 months from being released. He denied being involved in it, said he'd never been to the bar. Eventually, under questioning of my investigator, he admitted that he was there. He was an American Indian that had a drinking problem. He admitted to blackouts. And then he said he remembered having an argument over the bathroom, and he commented about how he woke up with blood all over him the next day and wondered what happened. So this is called admission of guilt. He didn't confess to the murder, but he admitted to elements of the crime. So with that admission of guilt, with the DNA results, we went to the prosecutor's office to let Ray Krohn go. He's innocent. He said, he's not going anywhere. We know he did it. We had the bite mark evidence. So it took a few more months of arguing, and actually a local reporter from the Phoenix, Arizona Republic made a front page headline article about how all these recent tests and all the DNA and everything pointed to this man that had a history of sexual assaults against women and how me, Ray Krohn, was still in prison for a crime it appeared clearly I did not commit.
I'm speaking with Ray Krohn, who spent 10 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit. He's now with a group called Witness to Innocence. What was it like being on death row?
Again, the deprivation. I mean, taking your freedom from you. I was locked in a cell the size of most people's bathroom. We were fed three times a day through a little hole in the front door, the cell door.
What were you fed?
When?
What? What was the food like?
We had the same menu. There was about five different breakfast items, about eight different lunch items, and about same eight different supper items. I never had red meat. I never had anything hot because they didn't allow death row inmates to prepare the food. It was prepared in another cell block and wheeled over in carts and sat in the hallways till the officers felt like feeding you. It was on season. There was no salt or pepper or anything like that, no condiments of any type. It was just enough to exist on, and I believe the calories was right at about 1,800 calories per person per day.
Mm-hmm. And did you have contact with the other guys on death row?
In Arizona, you're completely isolated. You're kept in your cell, separate from everybody. Whenever you left your cell, you were first strip searched, and then you were shackled at the waist and at your ankles. If another inmate was coming down the hallway, you were separated. When you went out to the rec yard, which was three times a week for 2 hours, you were in separate cages, 10 by 10 square cubes. So no, there was no physical contact with the other inmates. So you could yell out through your cell bars. You could yell out through underneath your door at some people and have a conversation that way. But it was open to everybody that was in that cell block.
And was there much of that communicating going on, or did people pretty much stay to themselves?
It varied. Now, we had some that we called ghosts. They would never come out of their cell. They would never talk. And there's a lot of people with mental illnesses, a lot of mental issues that go on in there to begin with. People that kill people horribly are not really normally sane to begin with, and there's no treatment there. But there's others. I mean, we are social animals in some ways, and there were other innocent people in there, and you wanted to voice that. You didn't necessarily tell all the details of your story, but it was good to know that other people in there that you had a sense of that you weren't the only one this ever happened to.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Ray Krohn, who is currently the Director of Communications and Training for the organization Witness to Innocence. Ray Krohn, 10 years in jail, in prison, on death row for a couple for a crime he didn't commit. How did being in prison all that time change you?
Well, it really made me think about something that I was never aware of. I didn't even have family members that were ever in jail or in prison. And so there's this thing I usually thought like the death penalty. I used to support the death penalty, in fact. I believe it was for the worst of the worst. You know, I found out a lot of things that scared me. In some ways, it was just to clear the case log, just to get somebody arrested, to take the media attention off, the public outrage off the police departments. A lot of things that you think, you know, it's a jury of your peers. It's, you know, you get a fair trial. You get adequate representation. I found out a lot of those things weren't true. And I realized that they can do it to me and my family. They can do it to anyone in this country. And so if those 10 years were going to be about anything, I realized that I should go and speak and talk to people and let them know what is happening. Because I believe all of us, you know, we want justice. We want fairness. And we pledged allegiance each day as a kid, you know, with liberty and justice for all. And you believe in that. It's something to hold in close to your heart and in your soul. And I wanted to see that people understand that they didn't become like me, that had an opinion a mile wide but only an inch deep because I never put my head beneath the surface. Now I seem below the surface. And I want people to know that. And then from that, I believe from education, people can make their own judgment, and a clear judgment, a true judgment.
And how did you connect up with people and organizations dealing with the death penalty?
Well, the day I walked out, I was 10 years, 3 months, and 8 days in jail and prison. The day I walked out, not only to reunite with my family and friends at the age of 45, but also to the distinction that I was the 100th person in America to have faced the death penalty, only later to be released, to be exonerated, to be shown to be innocent. So there was a lot of media coverage. A lot of events were going on all around the country for 100th person, the 100th mistake we have now made. And as a result of that, and speaking to the cameras and media, other groups around there wanted me to come and tell my story. And it just, after being able to speak about it first off and not having too many nightmares and traumas from recounting the story, I was able to continue to do that and worked with different groups, everybody from Sister Helen Prejean with the Moratorium Campaign to Witness Innocence to the Innocence Project to National Coalition to Abolish Death Penalty. There's a lot of both state groups and national groups that recognize the voice of innocence as a very powerful voice in this movement for justice reform and for abolishment of the death penalty, and I was able to become one of those.
Are you still having those nightmares?
No, it's not so bad. Again, whenever you talk about this thing, and again, some of the pain that I suffered was not near as horrendous to me, to justify to me, as it was what it did to my family, to my mom, my sister, people that fought real hard for me.
And is your mom still alive?
My mom is still alive. My sister's still alive. I lost my grandparents while I was in there. My grandpa died while I was still on death row. My grandma died right after my release, so she at least knew I was free, but she died before I got back to Pennsylvania.
Now, how many, you were the 100th, how many death row inmates have been exonerated right now, up to now?
Again, it is something that's frightening and something that needs to be paid attention to. I was released in 2002. I was number 100. Right now, we're up to 139. 39 more people in the last basically 7 years have been freed from prison. And that's just a small part that we're lucky, the fortunate people, the number of fortuitous circumstances that had to come in line at the right time to ever get your freedom. They're the few. There's still a lot more innocent people in there. And I'd like to be a voice for them, too, to say, you know, keep your hopes alive, to be strong, that there are people out here that care about it. And hopefully, possibly, that evidence will come up one day that will allow you to have your freedom, too, just like me and the other 38 people.
Now, Ray Krohn, does every state in the union allow DNA evidence? I know the Arizona legislature, you said, passed that law that allowed it. Or are there states that don't even want it in there?
They're coming around. Again, when this DNA first started back in the early 90s and stuff, it was, you know, wasn't that reliable. They weren't sure what they were doing with it. A lot of states now do have DNA tests, but not all of them. For example, I was down in Alabama. There was no right to DNA testing down there. Some of the states make it very difficult, and the burden is on the defendant. And after he's convicted, it's very burdensome, very hard. And a lot of states don't even provide adequate representation after you are convicted, during your appeals. So again, if that DNA wasn't maintained, if it wasn't even collected at the beginning, DNA is not the answer for people on death row in a lot of cases because, again, unfortunately, less than 20% of the murder cases involve DNA. So it's very, while DNA is definitive, you know, guilt or innocence, and not just proven innocence. In my case, it proved who was really guilty. But it's not always there. It's not the silver bullet. It's not the cure-all to stop wrongful convictions.
Well, what other mechanisms are there to stop wrongful convictions then?
Well, there's a lot of different states now that have had problems with exonerations. For example, up in Illinois, where the governor, you know, commuted all the sentence to life sentence. He realized that he had 13 exonerations and 11 executions. He wondered, what's going on here? More people were freed for innocence than I executed. And so they had commissions set up in different states to review the death penalty, review the system, how it's carried out. And they came up with a lot of recommendations. Some of the common ones were, of course, just having videotapes of the interviews, the police interrogations. A lot of these guys went down there for alleged confessions or signing confessions. Some of these men couldn't even read or write and supposedly signed a confession. The way photo lineups are done can be very intimidating and can be coerced by the way it's handled by the police department. So there's other issues just besides DNA, the way certain parts of the interrogation process, the pre-arrest and pre-trial procedures that heavily affect the penalty phase, the trial phase.
Ray Krohn, a lot of people who study the death penalty issue conclude that it's biased, that it's racially biased. Do you have that same conclusion?
Absolutely, and the numbers are out there. And it's not actually based on the race of the perpetrator. It's actually based on the race of the victim. Over 80% of the people that are on death row was a result of a white victim being murdered. And in some states, I was recently in Alabama, I believe about 70% of the death row is people of color, and yet less than 20% of the murders were committed by people of color. So it is, and studies have done and shown, I mean, it's the poorest, the least represented that are going to death row. You don't see the rich or famous ever facing a death penalty.
What about harder cases and in cases like, you know, the D.C. sniper, for instance, John Allen Muhammad? It was pretty clear, I think, to most people that he actually did the deed there. What is the case against the death penalty when there's no question about guilt?
Well, and those are outrageous acts, and those are the ones that usually the prosecutor employed. Pro-death penalty site, the Dahmers, you know, all these horrible murders. These people aren't sane people. There's something wrong in them somewhere along the lines that went haywire. And just like we try to prevent cancer from happening by we know what the cause are, I wish that people would start looking at the beginning, the root causes. These people are in poverty. These people don't get a proper education. They come from abusive families and neighborhoods and backgrounds. If we could start preventing that early, there wouldn't be so many victims out there. But even these ones are guilty of these horrible crimes and murders. I mean, we say, well, obviously he's clearly guilty, and we're sure of some of them. But where is the line then of those ones that you're not quite sure of? How far does that get distorted then to say, well, everybody's guilty? They thought I was guilty too. They were sure I was guilty. They were sure the other 139 exonerees were guilty. Where do we decide which one are the truly obviously guilty and which ones are the police and prosecutors say he did it? We know he did.
Justice Scalia, the right-wing Supreme Court justice, thinks that, you know, that vengeance is actually an adequate justification for executing someone. And, you know, there's the eye for an eye thing. This is, again, when you're guaranteed, if there ever can be a 100% guarantee that the person did the deed. What do you make of that?
Well, again, I mean, there's a lot of references to the Bible. It's funny, the only one they remember is the eye for the eye. They don't remember the story of Cain and Abel. They don't remember some of the murders that were occurred, you know, in the Bible. They also don't remember that, you know, that he without sin cast the first stone. They don't remember that the cities where people were allowed to go if they were a murderer. They were allowed to go there and find protection. There's a lot of ways to interpret a lot of things. But I just believe this. If you actually are acting out of revenge, jealousy, anger, envy, those are all our negative emotions. They bring out the worst in people, not the best. Than people. And if this is an act of revenge, if this need for revenge, then I think as society, as individuals, we might have that right in our own selves to do that, but not as our government. Our government should never act in nature of revenge.
I talked with Sister Helen Prejean once, and you work with her, and she said that, you know, families that are wanting to go to the execution thinking that it's going to give them closure, actually, it doesn't give them closure. And that desire for revenge is somehow either unquenchable or doesn't taste very good once you get it. So there may be something wrong in that regard as well. What is Sister Helen Prejean like?
Oh, she's a wonderful lady. I was fortunate. Actually, the first time I met her was when I was on Arizona's death row. She was able to get to be allowed to visit the inmates there and walked around, and I actually was able to talk with her a few minutes. It was funny, almost 10 years later, I was actually working for her group and with her group. But what a wonderful lady, and how she came about her journey to fight the death penalty was just that she got involved almost on a dare, if you will, to go and visit death row inmates and became connected with their plight and seeing how these are actually people and human beings, and her sense of humanity saying, even though the horrible acts they committed, there still had to be some redeeming quality in them. Part of what your faith teaches is that we all have something good in us if we're created by our God. And it became a powerful lesson to her that she had to take it on as a life's mission and cause to pretend to talk to the people about how this death penalty hurts people, how these people expect closure. It doesn't happen when that death occurs. That closure should start beginning, you know, with their help right after this murder happened. And it's not a closure, but it's a healing process that's usually avoided because these people have to be used by the prosecuting police to be brought back before a jury, brought back before a judge, brought back before parole hearings, and relive the horrible nightmare of the loss of their loved one, the horrible crime, to show that anger, to get the jury and the judge passionately angry at the perpetrator to get these harsher penalties, and the prosecutor continue to promote these people instead of help these people.
So they're exploited.
Absolutely.
The victims' families are exploited. Tell me about your organization, Witness to Innocence.
Witness to Innocence, again, was originally founded by Sister Helen Prejean. It was an outreach that we realized that just because you're exonerated, you're free, does not make your life all whole again. You have a lot of losses and gaps, and we wanted to reach out to exonerees once they got out of prison. And we're also our own little therapy group, only a handful, a few distinct people that went through that process, that system, that horrors, that being accused of a murder you didn't commit and going to death row for, being called human waste and a monster. This was a chance for these people to get together with other people that went through similar things and strengthen ourselves through our own personal experiences, and also then become a voice about what can and does happen in our country and call out for people to change and to look at this death penalty and see, is it really what we want as Americans? Does it really do what we believed it to do? Does it really stop murders? Does it really lower our crime rate? Does it really help the victims' families, which is very, very important.
You mentioned losses and gaps there, and I'm just wondering what the losses and gaps that you had. I read an article that you said when you came out you were not like the person you were who went in, that you came out paranoid, and how'd you deal with all that?
And again, it's difficult. I'm very fortunate because of family and friends that stood by me. I'm one of the few that actually got out first off by identifying who did it. Some men that were released, the prosecution police still claim that they did it and got away with it. They got off in a technicality. I don't know what the horrors of my life would be like if I had to live under that cloud. Also, with the support of going back to my small community where everybody believed me back then, helped me readjust. And again, I want to give that help back to other people that now need it, because that support that I've got made all the difference in my life, and not everybody is that fortunate to have that background and that support.
So you got back to the roots of your community where generations of your family grew up and everyone knew you and they stood by you. So it's an important lesson if people can readjust that way. How do people get in touch with the organization? How do you want people to help in this cause?
Well, Witness to Innocence has a webpage, witnessinnocence.org, I believe it is. There's people can get involved in their own states. Most states have some type of anti-death penalty movement, or at least a civil rights movement. There's even donations. If you don't have the time, possibly have a little bit of money like you'd like to donate. Again, that's on our website. But I believe this. People, anything that has the ability to take your life and freedom from you is something we should know about. Learn a little bit about that justice system. Learn a little bit about how it works in your state. And if you feel compelled to act, stand strong and unite with people of common faith and causes, because we can make a difference in this country. We can bring about change for the good.
Well, that's a strong note to end on. Ray Krohn, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. The website, again, is witnesstoinnocence.org. And I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This has been Progressive Radio. Thanks again, Ray.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.